Hello and welcome to the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast, our weekly look at the goings-on in the world of professional cycling. My name is Richard Moore and today I'm joined by Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Don't wave, Lionel, that doesn't come across well on the podcast. And by Daniel Freeb. Daniel, where have you been?
I don't know, I'm speechless.
Speechless comes across even worse than waving.
I've been busy. You know, I've been working on a secret project. I can't divulge any details about it yet.
I think you might divulge details about it last week.
Really?
Possibly hinted at it. Oh, Lionel, you've been on holiday.
I have.
You're looking very tanned.
Well, I wouldn't
expect. Nah, you're not.
Nah, not really.
I just made that up. Isle of Wight?
Isle of Wight, yeah. A friend's wedding. On the Isle of Wight, that's why we went there. And we stayed a few days longer, and I did a lap of the island on my bicycle. It was marvellous.
Well, you're looking
How
well.
Far is that?
You're looking well for it.
It's 67 miles.
Hard?
Pretty
Full
hard.
Gas?
I rode it with.
Did any threshold efforts?
No, I rode on a bike with mud guards and panniers, and took it fairly
that's
easy.
A bit disappointing.
I know.
Right. Well, we've got a really packed program today, including some incredible competition prizes. We've got to announce as well the winners of the Charlie Wigelius book from the competition last week. But tonight, or today, we are also awarding to some lucky winners 3 pairs of VIP passes to the start or finish of any stage of the Tour of Britain, and a place in the Garmin Sharp team car for any stage of your choosing. So listen up for later on in the program, and we're going to be giving you the questions which will hopefully result in those prizes. Lionel, where are we?
We're in the South Bank
Centre. This is getting repetitive now, isn't it?
We are.
This worked really well at the tour.
Yeah. We are in the South Bank Centre until further notice.
You should have, if you'd said Royal Festival Hall, because that's where we actually are.
Let's vary it a bit.
That would have varied it slightly.
No, that's the next one along.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
Well, it was a great start to our latest Humans Invent podcast. What are we going to talk about today? The obvious one is the Vuelta, which is nearing its conclusion, a few days to go. And still, we've been talking about Chris Horner every week. But let's talk about someone else. Let's talk about...
Have you been talking about Chris Horner? Because I actually would quite like to talk about Chris Horner.
Yeah, well, have you not been listening to the podcast?
No.
Well, what have you...
I didn't know it was still going.
What are you...
I saw a few tweets about it. These random guests that you've been inviting.
Random guests?
That's the first I knew
of it. Distinguished guests, Daniel.
What
are your thoughts
on... people who were invited.
What are your thoughts on Chris Horner?
No, this is a subject that interests me because... I've heard Chris Horner refer to, you know, he's kind of checkered in the sense that it's kind of a career he's had with a lot of injuries, a lot of illnesses, periods where he spent a long time away from sport, and he has presented this as a reason for him being fresh and younger than, you know, having fewer miles on the clock, so to speak. Now, I've spoken about this before to physiologists, and I've done a bit of research about it, and there's very little information or even a kind of consensus about whether this is a theory that holds any water whatsoever. You know,
in terms of whether, we should point out that Chris Horner is 42.
Yeah,
and he's, you know, second overall as we speak, but he's still got a very good chance of winning the Vuelta.
Yeah, but, you know, it's something that intrigues me, whether, you know, if someone races more intensively than someone else of the same age, does that make them, does that give them greater longevity? I don't know, but it's something that he has, as I said, suggested. I mean, one thing about Chris Horner that, if you ever speak to Marco Pinotti, the BMC rider, about Chris Horner, he says that he's got a very interesting mental approach, and he really does not consider his age and any kind of obstacle whatsoever. He has the same attitude at 42 that he had at 26, 27. If you spoke to Chris Horner now about the future of his career, you would think that you were talking to a 30-year-old. You know, he's not thinking of the end of his career.
No, he, as you mentioned last week, he wants to carry on another 2 years at least, and that, you know, he could feasibly still be a pro at 45.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The way he's going,
yeah,
it is a remarkable story.
Yeah.
One that inevitably is shrouded in a bit of suspicion, or certainly accompanied by questions.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the one sort of mitigating factor to that speculation, I would say, is that I was actually thinking of Sandy Cazar earlier because he announced his retirement this week. And he was a rider in that generation who probably suffered due to widespread doping. However, when I think most of us agree that that sort of trend did diminish after about 2007, 2008, 2009, there were certain riders who really emerged in 2009, 2010, 2011, and it was almost as though their real talent shone through. Now, Chris Horner is someone who has, he's thrived, you know, in the last 4 or 5 years. So that could mean one of two things. That could mean he's still doing whatever he was doing before that and other people have stopped, or, you know, he was a fantastic natural talent all along, I don't know.
He's a quirky, unusual character. We have spoken a little bit about this. I remember last year being at the Radio Shack training camp in Mallorca, and being out on the roads in Mallorca, and I was up a hill one day waiting for Team Sky to arrive. They were training there as well, and they were doing some efforts up this hill. And this lone figure in Radio Shack gear appeared before any of the Sky riders, and it was Chris Horner out training on his own. And that's apparently what he does on training camps. He trains on his own. He doesn't train in a group very much.
Hmm.
So he's a slightly unusual character. Lionel, you any thoughts on the Vuelta beyond Chris Horner? What are you? I mean, Nibali cracked the other day towards the finish, and the race is still very much open, it seems.
I remember a few weeks ago talking before the Vuelta started about whether Nibali was coming in slightly undercooked, and that whether he would ride himself in and the final week he would prove to be the strongest. But actually, as the race has gone on, he didn't look terribly comfortable on the day when he lost that bit of time to Horner. And you can't say that was the cold, miserable weather, because he's won Giro in equally, or in fact worse conditions probably, colder and wetter. So it's going to be really interesting over the final few days of the Vuelta to see whether he has got enough left in the tank to hold off Horner, because the one thing about Horner is he will go bang in a spectacular way through trying to win the race. He's not going to race for second place, I wouldn't have thought. He's going to try and turn the screw, and, you know, anything could happen on the Angliru.
It's been a good race, actually. I've probably watched this Vuelta a bit closer than I have in recent years, and I've enjoyed it. I mean, there's been a lot of criticism about how tough it's been, and that's probably valid, but it's been quite an enjoyable race.
Yeah, it kind of poses a bit of a challenge. It has done for the last 2 years, posed a challenge to the sort of received wisdom now that courses shouldn't be too hard and they shouldn't be too mountainous, because it makes for boring racing, because riders are too frightened to go onto the attack. I mean, I think where the Vuelta organisers, the route planners, do well is that the climbs tend to be quite short at the end, and the stages themselves probably on average slightly shorter than the other Grand Tours. So there isn't that kind of fear factor that riders do have in the Giro and the Tour.
I think the thing about the Vuelta this year and on for patches of the last 2 or 3 years is that the scenery has been a lot better to look
that's
at.
True.
And, you know, they went into the French part of the Pyrenees this week, at the weekend, which you know, just looked fantastic.
Beautiful.
You know, the late summer, you know, everything got a bit greener than it even was during the Tour. And I think you can't, when you sit down to watch a bike race, you're sat watching TV for a couple of hours perhaps, and I don't think you necessarily process how much the scenery is affecting your kind of enjoyment of the race, but it clearly is.
And sometimes at the Vuelta it can be a bit barren.
Exactly. There have been Vueltas in the past where they have literally raced almost like a sort of Warner Brothers cartoon with the same background going behind them day after day after day, like a sort of roadrunner.
Literally.
And a few more people at the roadside as well this year, because of the areas that they've visited.
Yeah. Well, Alastair Fotheringham made this point a couple
of years
ago.
Our distinguished colleague.
Writes for The Independent, among others. Based in Spain, he says cycling is enjoying a kind of rebirth in terms of crowd numbers, certainly at the Vuelta in recent years, simply because of the economy. You know, it's a free day out for people, and, you know, people are rediscovering a kind of love of going out and watching the Tour of Spain from the roadside.
On a related topic, I'm sure Alonso's purchase of Euskaltel team will also do wonders for the profile of the sport in Spain as well.
Definitely. I mean, we basically wrote the obituary for Euskaltel a few weeks ago, didn't we?
We did.
And Alonso who, if people don't know, he had been linked with setting up a cycling team. It had previously been mooted that he would do so with the backing of Santander, the bank. There had been talk about Contador being the figurehead for that team. And now he's Alonso, you know, who is it's not a global sports star, he's certainly a pan-European sports star.
He's a Galactico.
He is the Galactico, yeah. And he, you know, if you've got people like that associated with the sport, you may well draw in.
It brings a bit of glamour.
How's he going to find the time, though? How is it not going to be a distraction? Because actually, I don't follow Formula One.
They only race 15 days a year. It's easy.
He's got all that free time.
It's not even a Grand Tour, is it?
No.
Anyway, this Vuelta has also seen the return of the French. Pinot has been riding well. Lost a bit of time today, actually, in the crosswinds, but he's been riding well, which is encouraging to see after his disappointing tour where he withdrew with illness, but was already really out of the race due to his fear of descents. He seems to have partially conquered that in this Vuelta. And then Warren Barguil, the young Frenchman, who first year pro, who's won two stages in great style. And I think that gives us an excuse to hear from Ciro.
And now, Pedaleur de Charme.
So that was Ciro introducing our Pedaleur de Charme, now an occasional feature of the podcast, not a regular
occasional
thing. It's only occasional, but you know, there are some times when it's deemed essential. To explain what the Pedaleur de Charme is, it's a someone who pedals with charm, as Daniel summed it up earlier on. But our Pedaleur de Charme this week is Warren Barguil, I think by universal consent. Would you agree with that, Daniel? You've been impressed by. What do you know about him? You've got a soft spot for young Frenchmen.
Well, I mean, he was clearly a prodigy. He rode his first pro races. He was still an amateur at the time, but he did ride some pro races a couple of years ago. The Tour de l'Ain, I think he was in the top 20, and you know, just exceptional for a 19-year-old at that time. And won the Tour de l'Avenir last year, and just looks very, very comfortable on pretty much any terrain. And you know, the way he won, I think it was on Monday, wasn't it? It was just extraordinary. Just I think Sean Kelly was commentating on Eurosport and talks about how he was being too nervous, he was, you know, attacking too much. But really, I mean, he just had the French expression, he had fire in his legs, or he had legs of fire, just on any kind of false flat, any rise. He was going to the front and almost taking himself off the front of the peloton by mistake. He had such good legs. And then to attack, I think he attacked about 10 kilometres from the finish, and then Rigoberto Urán came back to him within, was it two to go? And Barguil was just so lucid, just waited and decided that he was going to take a breather for maybe 20 seconds while Urán caught him, and then just stuck on his wheel and beat him in a sprint. And Rigoberto Urán, you're talking about one of the most established and sort of expert riders in that situation, except when an Olympic medal's at stake.
Urán has been stitched up like that before, famously, on the Mall last
year. There were some fairly close to the bone tweets or so after that.
I'll bet. No, but he did show maturity really well beyond his years, didn't he? He looked like an experienced rider, and there he is riding a Grand Tour, and he's what, 21?
Yeah.
20.
Yeah. 21.
Extraordinary. And we had, you know, there was a long period in cycling where we didn't see 21-year-old riders winning or even riding Grand Tours, but far less winning stages. What do you make of him, Lionel? Is he the real deal?
I think he's, well, certainly is this in this Vuelta. I mean, the difficulty is in France particularly, and Daniel, you'll be even more aware of this, but as an occasional reader of L'Equipe, you know, the French do go overboard a bit about their young talented riders, and I think we saw that with Pinot in the Tour. The pressure, I mean, you only have to open the papers to see sort of a spread on sort of one or two riders. I mean, the intensity of the glare on them is quite something to cope with. And so really, having a young French rider burst through and deliver a great result, a couple of great results, is good for the, you know, for the French cycling nation. But the key is to have three or four of these riders all kind of bringing each other up. You know, maybe there'll be, I mean, there'll be some rivalry between Barguil and Pino perhaps, and then, you know, they still roll on, and then perhaps collectively they can sort of share that kind of national weight of expectation.
Yeah. I mean, I think this generation, you know, you look around the sort of international scene at the moment, and I don't think France would swap their young riders with anyone. I mean, you look at them on the sprinting front, you've got Demar and Coquart, and Buhani as well, and then you've got Bardet, who rode in an outstanding Tour de France, Pino, Barguil. You know, I mean, we've all raved about how British cycling has really developed into a world power over the last few years, but they certainly don't have those talents.
Interesting, isn't it? I think there's a gap there in British cycling, young 20-something riders, and I think that possibly owes to the academy maybe losing its direction for a couple of years.
Well,
my sense is that the younger guys, you know, the Simon Yates, Adam Yates, who is sort of young 20s, I guess, isn't he? Mm-hmm. And then below that as well, there's some terrific juniors performing very well. And I think that there's great talent coming through, but they're a little bit younger than those French riders that you mentioned.
Yeah. I think huge credit has to go to the French teams, much, much maligned for many, many years. And 10 years ago, they realised that, you know, the future it wasn't going to be doping, it wasn't going to be EPO, the future was going to be, you know, alternative methods of performance enhancement. They didn't really have the money at the time to invest in it in the way that teams like Garmin, Sharp and Sky did invest in those things, but they certainly tried things. I remember Cofidis hiring a sophrologist. I didn't even know what a sophrologist is. I don't even know what one is now. Psychologists, you know, chiropractors, etc., etc.
Was it Europe Car with the ice tank? Is it that?
What
there
the
well?
France de Dijon with France the de Dijon cryotherapy? With the, is it?
Yeah.
So what was that, sophrologist?
Sophrologist. Right,
anyone can tell us what a sophrologist is. They can win a signed copy of Daniel's forthcoming book, Mountain Higher. Mountain Higher. Sophrologist, please tweet at Humans Invent, hashtag sophrologist.
If you can spell it.
But they did. They invested a lot of, if not money, then a lot of energy for a long time, and they really had faith in that it would come good eventually, and I think it has come good. And I also think that the French have quite a strong federation, which, you know, the under 23 national team has been hugely successful, and the selector now has moved over to the senior team, and I think there's a kind of effect there of they're all trying to emulate each other. They're part of a very successful movement at the moment, and Bardet is competing with Barguil, and Pino is competing with, you know, Roland, etc., etc. Well, yeah.
He's competing with gravity.
Yeah.
Okay, anything more to say about the Vuelta? We're kind of looking forward to the finish on Sunday. We'll wrap that up next week and discuss how the race was won. But any more thoughts on the Vuelta in the meantime?
Well, I think it's been... It hasn't quite panned out the way I thought it would with the GC race has, perhaps, but the mountain stages have been enlivened, certainly by Barguil and by one or two other riders. And the racing has actually been really entertaining to watch. It's certainly better than the Giro was.
Just an idea. You know, they've got best young rider jersey. What about a best old rider jersey? Yeah,
silver jersey.
A grey jersey, yeah. Okay, let's move on. The weekend there, I went and watched some bike racing. I was one of it's been a while, but I was one of very, very few people in the Eddy Merckx Velodrome in Ghent, which is not the velodrome where the sixth day is held, but it's a very nice facility. It's an old track that's been covered up recently, and it's a nice little arena. And it was host to the International Belgian Open, which is a new event on the track cycling calendar. And Mark Cavendish was racing there, along with a few other stars, I guess. The reason being that there were points up for grabs towards qualification for the World Cups, and the UCI have introduced a new rule whereby you need points to qualify for World Cups. Now, it was a fairly crazy scenario, because in the Madison, for example, which Cavendish rode with young Owen Doole, one of the young British riders who's very promising, there were points available for the first 8 finishers, but there were only 6 teams in the race. So I tried to get a late entry, you know, because there's still a slot in the World Cup up for grabs.
You didn't have a partner?
Didn't have a bike. And I couldn't race in my jeans. Although Rob Hales was there, actually, we could have teamed up. Might have been slightly...
Certainly for a Madison, similar height.
Similar
so
height.
You would have been a good partner.
Yeah, we'd have been good.
Yeah.
But that didn't happen. Anyway, it was an interesting weekend. It was interesting to see Cavendish there and racing with a view in the long term to perhaps competing at the Rio Olympic Games on the track. Daniel, you've been collaborating with Mark recently. What, you know, how's that gone? And where's Mark at the moment? Is he serious about?
He's at home.
Yeah. Is he serious about wanting to go to Rio and wanting to give track another shot?
Not too sure, really. I think he wants to leave that option open. And it, as you said, it was very easy to secure those points, and you need to secure those points. So I think he had the presence of mind to do it, and whether he will compete in Rio. I mean, the change in the events, which came prior to London Olympics, has not helped him really. I think the Omnium, it's a choice between the Omnium or the individual, the team pursuit.
Or and both, he could ride both.
He could ride both.
I think he's made for the Omnium. No, he could ride a good Omnium.
You know, in 2006 he'll be 31, and you know, he's spoken a fair amount about the sacrifices that concentrating on the Olympics has demanded from other British riders, and he's been quite critical of those sacrifices. You know, he thinks Geraint Thomas shouldn't have gone for a second Olympic gold in the team pursuit. So, you know, at 31, that will be probably one of his... He will know that that will be one of his last very, very good years, I'm sure. And whether he will want to spend a whole year focusing on that, I don't know.
I have to say, he looked very, very good. He looked very comfortable. It was a good field. He was second in the scratch race. It was interesting watching him in such an unfamiliar surrounding, because you're so used to Cavendish being a race-winning position and then just... putting the throttles on and winning. That didn't happen. Sprinting on the track is a very different proposition to sprinting on the road. And I actually spoke to one of the other riders who was competing about that, Martin Irvine. Martin Irvine is the world scratch race champion, one of the highlights of the World Track Championships this year, really, when he rode the pursuit, he reached the final of the pursuit, he got beaten in the final, so he got silver medal, and an hour later lined up for the scratch race. A bit of an afterthought, and I don't think he was committed to riding it until quite soon before the event. Anyway, he rode it and he won it, and it was one of their most remarkable performances at those World Championships. So he was riding at the weekend there in his rainbow jersey of world champion. He's had a very difficult season.
I hope we're getting an interview here, because it's a very long intro, I was going to say.
And I spoke to Martin Irvine, and here he is. So, Martin Irvine, we're at the track in Ghent where you've been racing this new event, the Belgian International Open. And you rode in the scratch race yesterday. Was that your first race in the rainbow jersey?
Bar at the National Championships last weekend. Yeah, it was my first time on the boards, anyway, an indoor velodrome, since I won it. Yeah.
How did it feel to put that jersey on and to line up? And what was quite a strong field wearing that jersey?
Yeah, I mean, it was a new... I don't know, you get a bit more interest when you're a world champion, I suppose, but I kind of knew where it was coming from with breaking my hip earlier on in the year, so I kind of had to be sensible about it. But it was pretty cool. I mean, more, you know, even the other riders were like, wish I had that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's kind of a cool thing to have, yeah.
I mean, you've had a very up and down few months since winning the world title. Did it change things for you? You obviously won a contract with United Healthcare. It's a big team, and that was a great opportunity. But you know, did it actually change life for you, becoming world champion?
No. When it happened, I thought, happy days, you know, the ball's finally rolling where I wanted to be, you know, and then what, 4 weeks of the day, I think I broke my hip, so that kind of just killed my progress, if you put it that way, you know, because it was kind of, I finally got going, you know, and I felt good, and I hoped to build on it with the road team, so that was kind of stumped, all right.
It was a terrible injury you suffered. Can you just tell us exactly how that happened?
Yeah, it was just it was Tour of Taiwan, just flicking a bunch, bit of, you know, on the line out, and me not paying attention when I should have been, maybe, and then I was sliding along the ground. I hit a small curb, which just shattered my hip. So, I mean, there's nothing I could have done about it. It was just wrong place, wrong time, I suppose, but... I've been looking for the silver lining in it, but I haven't found it yet.
Yeah. Still looking.
Yeah.
Tell us about the layoff then. I mean, how long were you off the bike? When were you able to start light training again?
July. Started July is when I first started training again, you know, so a few months just trying to do the basics again. For a month solid, you just can't move, and it's horrible, you know, so it's it's pretty painful getting going again, and then just even learning to walk at the start. It's funny, you know, all the scar tissue and muscle just falling asleep. But once I got going, I think it kind of took off, you know. Once I could walk, I could, you know, I got back on the bike and start getting strong again. So, you know, I just jumped in with the racing the last few months.
It must have been so frustrating, you know, within weeks of, you know, this career-defining victory and this race win that could have changed the whole direction of your career, to be just lying around. Not, you know, did you have the rainbow jersey pinned up on the wall or anything for motivation or
point? Yeah, I mean, the jersey's still in the bundle somewhere. It's hard in the head, you know, more than anything, just trying to figure out what ifs, and you, can you imagine if that happened, if it had kept going, what happened? But I'm a negative person, but I try to think positively, if that makes sense. Look for the positive in it, which, you know, I got married and stuff, so that's kind of maybe the bright side, you know. So when I was at home, I got married, and I don't
was
know.
That,
maybe
was that planned, or was
that? That wasn't planned. Yeah. That was because I'm never at home. So
that's your silver lightning.
So there's a bit of it, yeah. I was in the form of my life then. What happens if I kept it going, you know? But sure, that's life.
And you returned to racing Tour Portugal, didn't you? Last month.
That was 2 or 3 weeks ago, and I crashed in it, so that didn't even help.
You got through about three stages, I think, didn't you?
Yeah. Fourth stage hit deck, I think. Rolled the tub and just skinned myself, you know, and give me my dodgy hip a good thump, so it works. Makes it strong again. That was the bonus out of that crash. But yeah, not the comeback I wanted.
How are you feeling now? I mean, you raced yesterday, you give it a good go in the scratch race, and then pursuit today, and you're building up for a full sort of winter track season, aren't you? How's the form? Do you feel that you're going to be able to get back to the form you were in last winter?
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised. I know the scratch didn't go the way I wanted, but I raced the way I usually did. I just wasn't as fit to finish it off. So the strength was there in the first half of the race, and I felt good. And the first couple of K, I felt grand. It's just when the fitness at the end wasn't there. So I suppose 2 months ago, I was thinking, will I ever get back to being that fit again? So I'm not a million miles away from it, so that's a bonus.
How did Cavendish look? He was riding the scratch race yesterday, of course. What were your impressions of him?
Yeah, he's pretty nifty on the track bike for not being on it for a while. Yeah, he looked comfortable, and I think that speed was always going to show at the end. Yeah, he definitely didn't look under pressure now, which is pretty impressive.
We were talking about this earlier, the sort of strangeness of seeing Cavendish on the track and taking part in a sprint as he did at the end, and being beaten when he was in a great position. And you were talking to me a little bit about the differences between sprinting on the track and sprinting on the road.
The track, you're stuck in the one gear, so the change of speed's not as impressive. Well, I suppose it is, but if you can bang it down two gears and take off, that's a bonus thing. That's what Cav's good at. He's just accelerating is good. But I think when everybody's in the same gear or similar gear, it's less, you know, you can see it less. Obviously the natural speed's still there, but less of an effect on it if you're all stuck in the one gear.
Yes, yeah, it's strange because we're so used to seeing him just accelerating away from people. He's got that sort of second kick on the road as well. Yeah. And also on the road, he's out the saddle. He's able to get that very aerodynamic position. On the track, he tends to be in the saddle, so it's quite different.
And the guys he's racing, I know the guy that beat him is Dutch, and he's got a European Championships at home in a few weeks, so he's probably fit as a fiddle, and you don't know who's doing what. And you know, obviously, Cav's not got a million miles in track leg, you know. Minimizing the track, so yeah, it all shows, and that, you know, he can still jump on it and do pretty good.
Yeah. What's next for you? I mean, you were on a 1 year contract at United Healthcare. What are your options? Do you have any options at the moment on the road for next season?
To be honest, I'm holding my breath and hoping, you know. I have nothing concrete yet, so I suppose I need to start worrying about it soon. But I think when I go home, I'll start knocking a few doors again and saying, what's the story, and try and put pen to paper. But nothing concrete yet.
Is there an option? Do you know if United Healthcare might be an option for you next year?
Yeah, I think so. I was talking to them, and they want to do something with me, you know, but they're just busy off racing at the minute, you know, so I don't want to pester them too much. They've got Tour of Alberta at the minute and Tour of Britain, so I don't want to be that guy, you know, so I'll say nothing for a while.
Your teammate, Philip Dignan, who you wouldn't have ridden with all that much this year.
Training camp, January, February, last time I seen him. Maybe at the Nationals, I went up and had a look when I was on my crutch.
He signed for Team Sky this week. What do you make of that, and what do you think? How do you think he'll get on there?
It'll be good for him, you know. He's kind of, he's best talent in Ireland, one of them anyway, and that kind of regime of the track that Sky have, the nurturing of it, you know, I think it'll only show how good he is. I really do, like, you know, because maybe with other teams there's a bit of lack of direction sometimes and you get unmotivated. I think Sky's a perfect platform for him to show off.
And otherwise for you, it's a full winter of track racing. You're going to do all the World Cups and then the World Championships as well.
Yeah, same thing. Yeah, I think I have a 6-day sign, maybe try and get another one. You're just trying to do as much as you can, because had a big holiday there, you know.
Just looking back at the Worlds last year, your world title, which came as such a surprise, it was just an hour after the pursuit where you were in the final and you got silver medal there, and then you popped up with this incredible... Do you still sort of pinch yourself at what happened?
That still gives me a chuckle, like, because you couldn't script it, like, you know. It's maybe all the Omnium chain in the last few years paid off there, you know. There's a load of things you could put it to, but I'll tell you now, the first half of that race was torture. I just like flick a switch and I felt great, and that's when it mattered, you know. So if I could do that again next year, it'd be great.
So you just have to ride a pursuit before every scratch.
Good warm up, two pursuits, and I'll be grand, you know.
You must have it on video or watch it on YouTube or something. Do you ever, especially when you were sort of off the bike, did you ever watch that?
I seen it a few months ago again. It got me sweating again, you know. It's kind of funny watching it, but yeah,
it's thinking, will he hang on?
Yeah, no, that's not going to happen. That's kamikaze, that move. Yeah, so it's pretty funny. Yeah, maybe I'll see it again, give me a kick in the hole.
And I mean, you said it doesn't make a great deal of difference, but over the winter when the track season kicks in, will there be offers to, you know, appear at races, or, you know, is the World Champions jersey worth something to you at this time?
Yeah, I mean, it got me into a few sixes, you know, it got me in the door to talk to them, so that's something that would never happen. I wouldn't be a guy to go and network too much, which is probably my downfall, you know, so I think the jersey does that for you nearly. Definitely seeing there's a few more doors open in the velodrome that way.
Great, well, best of luck, Martin. Hope you have a great winter after a disappointing summer, and good luck for next year as well.
Cheers, thanks very much.
This is the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb.
So that was Martin Irvin we heard from there, and welcome back to the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. We've got a couple of prizes to announce. Last week we asked how many Giro d'Italia, how many times has Charlie Wigelius ridden the Giro d'Italia to win copies of his book Domestique, signed copies of his book Domestique. We have two to give away. Now I asked Charlie for confirmation and he replied 9. But everybody on Twitter who entered this competition said 8.
And what does the record book say?
The record book says 8, so Charlie was wrong. So I corrected him. And
disgraceful human being.
Terrible, terrible. I wouldn't go that far. That's a bit harsh. Anyway, we had a lot of entries to the competition, so thank you very much everybody who took the time to tweet. And our two winners are Russell Stevens, that's R.S. Stevens, 55, and Andrew Rowe, who included a whoop exclamation mark in his tweet, which
that's not Andrew Rowe from the, I'm thinking of Andrew Rowe.
Andrew Rowe, Rowmeister, 83. If you could tweet again to Humans Invent, at Humans Invent, and we'll arrange to send you these books. Now, this competition for prizes for next week's Tour of Britain are... this excellent prizes.
Phenomenal.
And you've got to be very quick here, though.
First come, first serve.
It's not first come, first serve. No, we're not going to do first come, first serve. We're going to set a cut-off point of midday on Thursday.
Right.
So please enter by midday on Thursday.
That's literally only hours away.
Literally hours away. So the prizes are 3 pairs of VIP passes to the start or finish of any stage, plus a chance to meet the Garmin Sharp team. Also, there is, for one lucky winner, a place in the Garmin Sharp team car for any stage.
Who's riding for them? Do we know?
Really exceptional. Who, for Garmin Sharp?
Yeah,
we know who's riding. Just can't remember off the top of my head. Right. Dan Martin's on the provision list.
What I can tell you, though, is when you get a day in a team car, you do get to eat the same sandwiches that all the team staff have.
Yeah.
So you'll get an authentic feel, and a taste of what it's like to be on the inside of a team.
And I remember I was in a team car once with Stephen de Jong, and he eats at 1 o'clock.
I've got a great Stephen de Jong story, but it's totally unsuitable for this podcast.
Well, he can't tell us that. Can you not edit it?
Definitely not.
That was an absolutely pointless intervention, Daniel. Pointless. No more like that, please. If anybody wants to know Daniel's story, they can email him. Can I say your email address?
No.
Okay, so these prizes. So for the VIP passes, so 3 VIP passes, please tell us who was the first British rider to win a stage of the new Tour of Britain, i.e. the one that was relaunched in 2004. The Tour of Britain has existed for many years, but it was relaunched in 2004. Who was the first British rider to win a stage?
It wasn't you, was it?
It wasn't me. No, that narrows it down a little bit. And the other prize for a place in the Garmin Sharp team car, actually, I believe Charlie Wigelius is the DS.
No, I don't think he is.
Apologies.
It is Geert...
Van Bont?
Yeah, the winner of Gent-Wevelgem years ago.
Apologies for that. I noticed that Brian Holm is the DS for Onager Pharma Quickstep. He loves Britain, doesn't he? So, to win a place in the Garmin-Sharp team car, please tell us, who was the highest placed Garmin-Sharp rider last year, in last year's Tour of Britain? Answers by midday, at Humans Invent, hashtag Tour of Britain competition. And give us your answers. First British rider to win a stage of the new Tour of Britain. And who was the highest placed Garmin-Sharp rider last year? Brilliant prizes courtesy of Sharp. Thank you very much. So let's talk about the Tour of Britain. Mm. It's a great field, isn't it?
It is. It is an excellent field. It's probably the strongest field since the race returned in 2004, although they do say that every year. But, you know, each year the field gets stronger.
And so they're not lying?
No, they're not at all, no. And I think this year's course is even more challenging than last year's, which obviously we remember hinged on Caerphilly Mountain, the stage in South Wales where they go twice over Caerphilly Mountain, and that was where Jonathan Tin and Locke put the hammer down and took the yellow jersey. This year I think the race will be decided there again, although for the first time in this new race's history there is a summit finish in Dartmoor. So the Tour of Britain has never had a summit finish before.
Nairo Quintana for that, perhaps?
I don't know whether this might have been discussed in one of the podcasts when I was cruelly snubbed, but...
Daniel, just to be clear, you weren't snubbed. You were unavailable for selection.
We'll discuss it later. Tin and Locke, that's a sad story, isn't it, this year?
It is a strange story, isn't
not,
it?
Not selected for the Sky team, despite the fact that he's the defending champion of the Tour of Britain. Yeah, I mean, that is slightly unusual, considering the races he has actually done this year. It clearly hasn't worked out for him.
Yeah, he's got a two-year contract, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, there's either been an error of judgment there by someone, or...
It'd be great to interview him, actually. I'd really like to get him on the podcast and speak to him about his year. I think there are various rumours about what's happened. You know, one of the rumours is that he lost a lot of weight, and perhaps that's been a misjudgment. Also, I think the role that he was asked to perform in races, you know, riding as a domestique is very, very different to riding as a protected rider. Mm. Some guys are good at it and some aren't good at it.
He's very much an individual person. I know Simon Barnes, who was the owner of the Ploughman Craven team, and back in Jonathan Tin and Locke's first attempt at becoming a pro rider, he rode for Ploughman Craven for a short while. And without kind of, criticising Tin and Locke too much, integrating him into a team unit was not necessarily the easiest thing. And he's somebody who follows his own path. And I think perhaps in the Sky team, that isn't really compatible with how they operate. You have to embrace the plan. And everything's kind of turned around to sort of rider focus. But rider focus is almost like the rider has to kind of state their goal and then follow it. Mm. And then it's when it doesn't work out, the plan is kind of presented back to them as if, well, look, this is what we agreed. You agreed to sign up for this, and this is how we were going to proceed. Now, purely speculating on how Tin and Locke's season has turned out, there were clear ideas about what he was going to do this year, and basically he hasn't done any of those.
Certainly ride a Grand Tour was on the agenda.
Yeah, and be fit for April and give it a crack in the Ardennes.
It's funny to think that a year ago he was a protagonist in the World Road Race. I thought even more than his performance in Tour of Britain to win that, I thought his performance at the World Road Race Championship was outstanding. There he was shadowing Contador, and a year on, he's not even selected for the team to defend his title.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if at the end of next year it hasn't worked out, whether Sky continue to view the British domestic scene as a valid talent pool. Obviously they had the experience with Russell Downing, who they took in the first year and was very, very unlucky, I think, not to get a contract. I think at the end of his second year he'd won races.
He was kept on for a second year, so the third year he was.
So the third year, and he'd won races that year. But it is, you know, obviously it's quite a vibrant scene now, the British domestic scene, with the sort of boom in interest in cycling in Britain. But it's interesting to see how these guys deal with that step up in class.
But there's more to the Tour of Britain this year.
The Jonathan Tiernan Lock Knot riding.
Yeah, definitely.
That was a great preview for the Tour of Britain, wasn't it?
Well, no, because one of the charms of the Tour of Britain is that you never really know who are going to be the protagonists for the week. But you tend to have years where certain riders kind of come to the fore. I mean, if you think back to the year when Edvald Boasenhagen seemingly won every stage, I think he won four in a row. In whichever year was that, 2009, 2010, I think Albasini was the strongest rider of the week, both technically and tactically. And in recent years, we've seen Lars Boom ride very well. We've seen the Vacan Soleil riders do well. Thomas De Gendt, I think, won the King of the Mountains, and Wout Poels won a stage, I think, and was up there. You see, when you look back over the history of the race from 2004 onwards, it's actually incredible to see how many riders sort of, if they, you know, first came to prominence in the Tour of Britain. Andy Schleck won the King of the Mountains in the Tour of Britain in, I think, 2006, was it?
I didn't know that, actually.
Cavendish has won the green jersey, obviously, when, you know, as a stagiaire, I think, for T-Mobile, if not for Great Britain the year before, one of those, so very early on. You know, we've seen the emergence of riders. Josh Edmondson last year effectively sealed a move to Sky with his performance on the Caerphilly Mountain stage, and has fared better at Sky than this year than Jonathan Tiernan Lock has. So one of the things of the week for
Lionel me knows a lot about Tour of Britain, doesn't he?
Well, I go every year. I really enjoy it. I like
Lionel
the fact
and I are going together next week.
Yeah,
we're reprising the trip.
Blimey.
The
Truth O'Reilly.
The Albie Steve Coogan again.
It's a week of full English breakfast.
Beautiful little
and English
guest
ale.
Houses.
You're listening to the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast, powered by Sharp.
Still talking about the Tour of Britain. Lionel has stopped salivating at the prospect of his week of English
Melton fried Mowbray pie.
His English fried breakfast next week. Let's talk more about the Tour of Britain.
That says a lot, doesn't it? Really? The rest of us look forward to going to the Giro. You know, the fine cuisine at the Giro. Lionel looks forward to the sausage rolls and Scotch eggs at the Tour of Britain.
It's a highlight of his year. So, on the British front, Team Sky have got unfinished business at the Tour of Britain. They're going there with Bradley Wiggins. They've got to win that race at some point. They have made a brilliant job of not winning it when they've been in a really good position to win it.
Do you remember 2010?
I was in the team car with Stephen de Jong eating lunch at 1 p.m. in 2010.
I've got a great Stephen de Jong story.
On the first stage last year. 2010, sorry. They had Bradley Wiggins, Geraint Thomas and Greg Henderson all in a big leading group. And they decided to put... Well, the instruction was for Wiggins to have a go with about 5Ks to go, nothing to lose. But Wiggins came back to the team car and said he was tired and he wasn't really up to it. So they decided they were going to lead out Greg Henderson. So they did their bit for him. But then both Geraint Thomas and Bradley Wiggins got tailed off in the final kilometre or so and lost quite a lot of time. That was the year Albasini was in that group and he ended up winning the race. Henderson won the stage, but that was really a false gloss on what had actually occurred that day, and that was a huge, monumental cock-up.
Just to explain Daniel's comment about Benny Hill tactics, that was Brian Holm, wasn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Who told anyone and everyone who would listen that Sky had used Benny Hill tactics
At a time when I believe Brian Holm has been spoken to as possible director for
Possibly,
Team Sky.
Yeah. I do remember, though, that year Sky... they didn't make themselves all that popular with other teams. For example, Albasini was in the yellow jersey, and their team was kind of falling.
That sounds like Team Sky.
Yeah,
sure, we're talking
odd
about the same
that's
Team
very
Sky.
Unusual behaviour.
Yeah, but remember, this was their first year, and they'd had a terrible tour in France.
Yeah.
Albasini was in the yellow or the gold jersey, if it was gold at that point. But their team was falling apart. They had quite a lot of sickness, I think, and riders were sort of riding on one leg, and they wanted. They wanted Sky to kind of share a bit of the pace setting on the front in exchange kind of for a freer run at the stage
run.
Sky turned that down, and HTC Columbia did what they could and set Greipel up to win the stage.
I'm on the stage
anyway.
And
it was just one of those days when all these stories kind of came out that night and the next day and the following week, and you just thought a little bit of kind of naivety in there. But I think you're absolutely right. They haven't quite imposed themselves on the Tour of Britain as you would imagine.
I mean, you know, it might not be the biggest race in the world other than for you, Lionel, but it is a very important race for them, being a British team, you know, big publicity.
It's also a really difficult race to control.
It is, six-man teams.
Mm. And narrow roads, you never really know. The Tour of Britain's one of those races where at the start of the week you can never mark the spot with the next where the race is going to be decided.
Caerphilly Mountain.
Serious question. Nairo Quintana coming here, finished second at the Tour de France. Will we see him? You know, because sometimes these guys come to race like the Tour of Britain and they are pretty anonymous.
I remember Andreas Clodin about half
yeah.
an hour.
Yeah, yeah.
Nearest to whichever airport we're getting back to Bavaria.
So, are there any airports on the route with direct flights to Bogota?
I don't think so.
Right.
Isn't there an issue over his visa? Is there?
There's always an issue over his visa.
When he's on the start line, then we can get excited about
And Sagan's riding.
Not Peter though. We're talking Uri.
Sagan, Peter's brother Uri.
I didn't even know he's still riding.
He's still riding. Oh yeah, he's down to ride. Oh, I mean, he's probably quite a good story. Mm. Uri. Daniel, you look skeptical about that.
No, he's a terrible rider.
Is he a terrible rider?
No, well, I mean, he's had no results whatsoever. I think he's been a pro 3 years now.
It is the Miguel Indurain Prudencio syndrome, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think it's going to be a great race because there's several little things that.
Speaking of brothers.
Flagged up.
Simon Yates and Adam Yates.
Exactly.
I'd be very interested. You know, last year we saw Josh Edmondson ride extremely well. Mm-hmm. Probably earned his place at Team Sky, actually, with his performance at Tour of Britain last year. Rode brilliantly in Caerphilly, I remember.
I said that about 4 minutes ago.
Did you? Oh, Edmondson?
Yeah.
I didn't hear that. Did he say that?
Yeah, you need to pay more attention, Richard.
Sorry. Okay. Well, Adam Yates, Simon Yates, they rode brilliantly the Tour de l'Avenir recently, 1-2 on a stage, and Simon Yates was second overall, wasn't he? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think this is a great stage for them, isn't it?
Yeah. I think there's several things. You know, there's the 10-mile time trial.
You couldn't
get a more British distance than the 10-mile time trial, and naturally we're going to look for Bradley Wiggins and Alex Dowsett going head to head in that, which may put one or other of them in the gold jersey. And then, you know, if that's the case, then we could see another British winner.
It's a strong team Sky are sending. They've got Edmondson, Bernie Eisel, Matt Heyman, David Lopez, Ian Stannard. That's a very strong team, isn't it? You were asking about Garmin Sharp. Dan Martin is down thread. He pulled out the Vuelta, of course, so he's riding the Tour of Britain. Jack Bauer, Nathan Haas, Robbie Hunter, Jacob Rath, and Steele Vonhoff. So that's the Garmin Sharp team. A reasonably strong team. Dan Martin should, if he's recovered from the Vuelta, ride pretty well. But yeah, as I say, these young British riders, I'm very keen to see what they're capable of as well.
I think the way the race is raced has evolved over the last 5 or 6 years as well, because in the past, when the race first started, 2004, 2005, 2006, what would typically happen would be a break would go on one of the first 2 days and a big gap would open up maybe 8-10 minutes between the first sort of 15 and then the rest. And so the GC race would be kind of a little bit kind of neutralised from that point on. With the inclusion of tougher stages, Caerphilly Mountain, the time trial, which is decisive as well, Caerphilly Mountain and Dartmoor, it makes those first couple of days, the one in Scotland and the Lake District, and then after the time trial there's a stage in the Potteries region, it makes it much more likely that the bunch will stay together for those stages, simply because they want to keep every big team will want to have an interest in keeping it together for the more decisive stages later on. And I think that makes the whole week, the ebb and flow of the whole week, a lot more interesting to watch than in the past we've seen, where the year Martin Pedersen won, he basically got away in a break. Mm. They won by many minutes, and it was then between two or three riders for the rest of the week.
There are also some fairly good sprinters in the field. Omega Pharma are taking Pataki and Cavendish, so it'll be interesting to see how they work together, and Viviani is there for Cannondale as well.
I think they'll work very well together, won't they? You mentioned the time trial, Lionel. One scenario which we covered a couple of weeks on the podcast, Alex Dowsett is hoping to ride the team time trial, which clashes with the final day of the Tour of Britain.
That's the World Championship team
time trial, and he has permission from the race organisers to withdraw from the Tour of Britain, but there's a very real possibility he might be the leader And he can get up those climbs as well, so that'd be a real dilemma for them, I think. And I don't know if Bradley Wiggins is down for the team time trial as well.
That's not great, is it?
It's not great.
In terms of scheduling.
No, it's not great.
I mean, not just for Dowsett, but for other riders.
I don't see why it would be still a bit of a clash, but I don't see why the team time trial couldn't be on the Monday at the World Championships. It's a bit of a free day.
The Cycling Podcast with humansinvent.com. Innovation, craftsmanship and design.
Okay, so any other business? We've got to mention Graeme O'Bree, who we had on the podcast last week, talking about his attempt this week on the world land speed record. He's out there in Nevada, kind of mid-attempts. He's tinkering away with Beastie, his contraption, in which he's attempting to set the world land speed record. There's brilliant coverage of this on humansinvent.com. It's probably the best coverage you will find, going right back to the origins of the attempt. So have a look there. It's fantastic entertainment, if nothing else. And he still might do it. Who knows? Daniel, there's a news story that's caught your eye this week concerning Milan-San Remo.
Yeah, the route will finally change. This has been mooted for quite a while. It's mooted, even going back years, it was mooted almost every season that there was going to be a change and that there have been changes. Let's not forget that the Poggio is a relatively late addition. I think it was added in 1960, and the Cipressa was added in 1982, if I'm not mistaken. So, and Le Magne was, I think, 2008 or 2009. There's been a constant evolution of the Milan-San Remo route, but this route change will really radically transform the pattern of the race. It's a third climb added to the finale between the Cipressa and the Poggio, and it's called La Pompeiana, and it's very similar to the Cipressa, but probably a bit more difficult, with one very hard kilometre, sort of two-thirds, three-quarters of the way up the climb. And I just think that sprinters will be ruled out now if this route change is retained for 5, maybe 10 years. I really cannot see how a sprinter will be able to get over those last three climbs.
It's a shame, because what we love, I think, and we're probably unanimous in this, what we love about Milan-San Remo is, I think you put it on Twitter, Daniel, that it could be won by a Grand Tour contender or a sprinter. It's got this great unpredictability about it, because it's just hard enough to make it hard, but not too hard to eliminate most of the field. And it's got this great unpredictability about it that makes it such an interesting, engrossing race.
Yeah, and I think that is the point. I think in reaction to the criticism, RCS might think and might say that, you know, these races, classic races, they're not immutable, they do evolve. You know, you mustn't hold on to whatever romance is related to the current route. But it's not that. It's not the fact that, you know, the route is set in stone and we all love it as it is. It is the fact that the race was brilliant. It's not just the route.
The race has been brilliant, hasn't it?
The thing is, I think the spring classics are going through a period of change at the moment. I think they have always been about identifying the moment of the race, and that moment of the race in, say, the Tour of Flanders traditionally came on the Mur or in the run-up to the Mur, or there's a kind of a parameter between which the moment that decides the race happens. And in Paris-Roubaix it's a lot less predictable perhaps than on Liège-Bastogne-Liège, it would be La Redoute. Or there's a trend now towards determining where the moment will be, and the organisers are trying to choose where the moment will be.
Trying to orchestrate it.
Perhaps for television, perhaps to make more of a kind of predictable story. The problem, the big sort of dichotomy really, is that great sport is about that fine balance, and in the case of Milan-San Remo, it's a balance between the sprinters and the attackers, and at one moment it appears that it's going to be a sprint, and then the next moment it appears somebody's going to get away, and then it all just, it's on the finest of margins and everyone is on the limit, and that is the beauty of the race. And I think it takes a certain amount of kind of without being snobbish about it, it takes a certain amount of experience of watching the race and knowing that, oh, that's the little bit of the climb that sometimes catches people out, or this is the moment where. But there seems to be this trend towards predetermining where that moment will happen. And whether that's organisers trying to make their events more appealing to television, whether it's TV companies saying, look, we need to know where we're going to put our advertising breaks so we don't miss crucial moments, I don't know, and that's your sort of like just left field thinking on my part. But the trend over the last 5, 6, 7 years has been about trying to make these races a little bit more predictable from the outset.
And another fantastic element of Milan-San Remo in recent years is that it has been won by riders who are perceived as sprinters, but if you go in and look at the circumstances in which they've won, they've actually excelled on those days, and they have actually they've actually showed sides of their riding which, you know, we're not used to seeing. Sierlec last year won in a group of what, 10, 9, 10. Goss won in a very, very small group. Even Cavendish, when he won, it was a relatively small group. So these are outstanding performances by these guys, and you know, it should take something special, whether it's from a sprinter or a general classification rider. And I think it currently, in its current format, it does. But I'm not sure that will.
It's
be the
a
case.
Race. It's one of those few races. It's so full of intrigue. I remember a couple of years ago, Simon Gerrans won from a group of Vincenzo Nibali and Fabian Cancellara, and that, to me, that epitomised the appeal, because there you had, you know, a Grand Tour winner. The greatest classics rider of his generation, and an opportunist, and the opportunist won, and there's just so much to talk about in relation to that particular edition. But that, to me, that summed up the wonderful. It was the only race in the world where those three might have made it to the finish in a group, and that was what was wonderful about it. I think we should probably wrap it up there.
Yeah.
We don't want to preview Milan-San Remo. It doesn't actually happen until next March, so we've got lots of time to think about that. Daniel, it's been an absolute pleasure having you back. Have you enjoyed it?
It's been a massive pleasure and a privilege to be back.
Have you enjoyed it?
I've really enjoyed it.
Do you feel at home?
I'm excited. When's the next one?
Next week.
I'm excited already.
Monday, maybe.
Brilliant.
Maybe do an early week one. Lionel, thank you very much.
See you for full English breakfast on the tour, Britain.
I cannot wait.